I welcome you to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word by inviting you to join me in Genesis chapter number 13, where we're going to begin at verse 18, where it says, "So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which were at Hebron. And there he built an altar to He Who Is." So we have already talked about how Abram came into Canaan at the direction of God right after his father's death in about 2101 BC. That's the date we can pretty confidently, I think, assign to it. But after living first at Shechem and then near Bethel Ai, a drought sets in, and so Abram heads down to Egypt for a bit. But now he's back after that. And he first reestablishes himself at the Bethel Ai encampment, but then at apparently the direction of God, the movement of God, he pushes farther south and ends up near what will eventually be the city of Hebron. Now, it is not that big city just yet. Right now, it seems as if it is some sort of trading post, a trading meeting area. We've talked earlier about this idea that people would meet under large trees because they were so easily seen from a distance. We're talking about really ancient ones. There was almost always a source of water nearby for that sort of thing. And if it came on one of the crossroads, even better. And that almost seems to be the situation here at what will eventually become Hebron. We've got a man by the name of Mamre. He is an Amorite. Amorite is a subgroup of the Canaanite people. I think I might have mentioned last time he was a Hittite. I was off by that. The Hittites, the sons of Heth, they're another subgroup of the Canaanites. And they will be at Hebron in a later story of Abram. But Mamre is one of three brothers. His other two brothers are Eshcol and Aner. And later in chapter 14, we will be told that these men are allies of Abram. And the literal word or phrase that's used there about ally is they are lords of the covenant. So these guys are powerful people in their own right. They are already well established here. They seem to be traders. They also run cattle and engage in trade in this region. And they do it under this stand of large terebinth trees. And now Abram shows up and probably first purchases water and grazing rights from them. But because he is very wealthy in his own right, it's not very long before they kind of invite him to join in their group, their alliance. And don't forget about the long-term effects of the Abrahamic blessing. Remember, God said, "I will bless you and all those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you." And so these guys now become a unit, a group, and become the basis for what eventually turns into the city of Hebron. And the reason I stressed all that is because while he is at Hebron, that's when the next story takes place. And don't neglect that while he was at Hebron, he built an altar to He Who Is. So he is well established there, just a few miles, about 30-some miles south of the modern city of Jerusalem. Chapter 14. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar. Now, Shinar is the region where the Tower of Babel was originally built. So just think Babylon. Arioch, king of Elisar. And we're not sure exactly which city this is a reference to, but it is somewhere in Mesopotamia. Gedorlaomer, king of Elam. Now, Elam, we do know. It is to the east side of the lower Mesopotamian region. It's on the east side of the lower Tigris River. And so this is also part of Mesopotamia. And Tidal, king of Goyim. Goyim is actually a word about nations or Gentiles. So it's not altogether certain where that might be a reference to, since this is a Jewish writing, if you will, a Mosaic writing. It may be a reference to non-Semitic peoples in Mesopotamia. Now, more than likely, given the time period we're talking about here, at the end of the 2100s BC and the beginning of the 2000s BC, these kings, as they are called, are probably part of the Gutian period of Sumer. Sumer or Sumeria is lower Mesopotamia. It is the first civilization center after the flood was finished, because it's related to the whole building of the Tower of Babel. And so it is likely that this is the beginning of the end of the Gutian period of Sumer, because shortly after this, the Ur III civilization rises in power there on the very lower end, the southern end of Mesopotamia. All right, so what's the deal? We've got these four kings of Mesopotamia that are in some sort of alliance. Verse 2, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the unnamed king of Bela, which will eventually be renamed as Zoar, because it's the only one of these five cities of the plain that survived the destruction that is coming later. Now, here, though, they were their own alliance in what is now the Dead Sea Valley, the lower Jordan Valley. And it says here in verse 3, as more of the story, all these, meaning the kings from Mesopotamia and the kings from the lower Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea Valley, all these joined forces in the Valley of Siddim, that is, the Salt Sea. So there's zero question as to exactly where we're talking about. We know exactly where the Salt Sea is. We know it better as the Dead Sea today. And in this time period, though, as a previous story told us, this whole region was very lush and green. When Moses tries to explain it to his Israeli readers, he said, it's like the Nile Delta. which is very green and lush and prosperous. It is like the Garden of Eden, which the Israelis, reading from the first book of Moses, would have had a picture in their mind of the Garden of Eden as being this place full of plants, a lovely place to live, a wonderful place to walk and contemplate God. Well, before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that's what the Jordan Valley and the area around what is now the North Basin of the Dead Sea looked like. Now, there was a time that I wondered whether or not the North Basin wasn't even there either. But I've been moving more to the idea that I think it is a little bit more permanent. It's about 1,000 feet deep at its deepest point. And the current level of the Dead Sea is about 1,400 feet below sea level. And I do still believe that much of the lower Jordan Valley dropped as part of this destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that happens during the lifetime of Abram. But before that, it was the center of a very prosperous prosperous civilization. In fact, so prosperous that other regions wanted to get in on their prosperity. And so verse 4 says, 12 years they, meaning the five kings of the Dead Sea area, had served Chedorlaomer. But in the 13th year, they rebelled. So let's talk about what that timing means. It means that while Abram was still living in Ur of the Chaldees, before he had even been moved by his father Terah toward Canaan and stopped at Haran, about 3 years before Abram headed south, this event of the Mesopotamian kings bringing the kings of lower Jordan Valley under their control took place. And so things were stable for about 12 years. But 13 years in, the Southern Alliance decided they didn't want to pay anymore, because that's more than likely what this is all about, is that they were paying out of their prosperity to Mesopotamia. Now, the description of Southern Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea Zone, is that it was called the Valley of Sidim, which means the Valley of Agricultural Fields. So again, we're emphasizing the idea that this is a wonderful place for growing crops. I also shared before that it would appear that the northern basin was already leaking bits of oil from underneath the crust up into the water of the Dead Sea. And this would float up and it would be harvested. It would be captured. There were also apparently pits of bitumen, as it was referred to, around this same region, probably where the South Basin used to be for the Dead Sea, which is now being more and more dried up in order to harvest all the chemicals that are in there. So this was a very prosperous region, producing a lot of food, producing a lot of bitumen, which could be used for lots and lots of different products and in a lot of different means and manners, which made the people of that valley very wealthy. This even, I think, contributes to the reason why God decides that they need to be taken down, and why the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other three cities associated with them were put on a schedule of destruction. Now, many people will immediately go, well, it's because they were engaged in sexual activity that was inappropriate, homosexuality. Yes, that certainly is part of it, but it is only one part of the symptom. We get that information, by the way, from passages like 2 Peter 2 and Jude, verse number 7, which describes that they were involved in immorality and going after strange flesh. That's actually a reference to when the angel showed up there and the locals tried to compromise them sexually. And so that is definitely part of the problem, but it's not all the problem. Ezekiel chapter 16 tells us the rest of the story. Now, it's not a nice passage. It's a rough passage because the prophet Ezekiel is being directed by the Holy Spirit to take Judah to task for their sinful behavior. And in so doing, the prophet uses a metaphor of Judah just being as bad as her evil older sisters. One of those sisters was Samaria, the northern kingdom capital that had recently been taken into Assyrian captivity. But another couple of the sisters were Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he zeroes in particularly on the city of Sodom. And remember, Lot was actually living in Sodom. And so I think that's why it gets highlighted so much. So in Ezekiel chapter 16 at verse 49, this is what it says. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride. Now the daughters here would be the other four cities: Gomorrah, Zeboim, Admah, and Bela. She had pride and excess of food. See, because it's so prosperous, they're growing tons more than what they can consume themselves. So they're selling off all of that excess food, which is probably why Chedorlaomer and his guys were interested in bringing the five cities underneath their control. But it's not just that. Let's keep reading in Ezekiel 16:49. And they had prosperous ease. They were fat and happy and could have a lot of free time on their hands because they had so much to sell elsewhere and to live off of and to kick back with. But what did they do with that excess besides serving themselves? Not much. It says, but they did not aid the poor and needy. So they were aware that there were plenty of people around that were not benefiting from all of that prosperity. There were people that were going hungry, even though they lived in the land of prosperity. There were people that were not properly clothed or housed, even though they lived in a country, in a region that had more than enough. Now, that's a problem. Verse 50 of Ezekiel 16, they were haughty. So they were full of themselves. And they did an abomination before me. So I removed them when I saw it. Now, one of the big things that happens when a society becomes super, super prosperous is that if they're not morally grounded, those that are at the top get the benefits of all that prosperity, while those at the bottom don't. And so you have the haves and the have-nots, and the demarcation line between the two becomes more and more distinct and glaring. And this is certainly a problem that keeps cropping up in Western civilization. We can even see it here in our own United States of America. And that selfishness of a good-sized portion is held in account by God as inappropriate behavior. Now, one of the other things that happens is when a society becomes super, super prosperous and it has more than enough, is they start getting kind of bored. And so they start experimenting. And one of the areas they experiment in is sexuality. And we certainly see that here in the United States as well. We've seen it as the prosperity of the United States has increased. And it happened in Rome, it happened in Greece, it happened in all these foreign societies in the past. So that's the thing that is going on in Sodom and Gomorrah, Zeboim, Admah, Bela. But in the 14th year of their peace treaty with the people out of Mesopotamia, they decided that they didn't want to be paying tribute to those people way over there. They wanted to keep all of their prosperity. Well, as soon as that happens, the Sumerian group, the group up in Mesopotamia, decides they've got to come down and reassert their dominance. They don't want to lose the prosperity of the southern Jordan Valley, but more importantly, they can't be perceived as weak. So Genesis 14:5, in the 14th year, which I'm going to assign that as 2091 B.C. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and they defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnaim. Now, this is a little side thing for us. The Rephaim is another name for giants. In fact, in the Greek text here, that's what it says, gigantes, the giants. Ashtaroth Karnaim is about 50 miles south and a little bit west, southwest of Damascus, and it's about 25 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. So we know exactly where these guys were coming through. They left lower Mesopotamia, probably traveled along the upper Euphrates till they got right around the Balik tributary, which is just south of where Abram and his family came from recently. There, it turns south onto what's called the King's Highway or the Royal Road or however you want to call it. And it goes southward toward Canaan. It passes past Damascus, and then it travels along the higher portions of the eastern side of the Jordan Valley. And so the first place that these guys run into kickback or resistance is at Ashtaroth Karnaim, just east of the Sea of Galilee. And it's from giants. And they put them down. And then it says that they did the same thing to the Zuzim in Ham. Now, who are the Zuzim? Well, according to Deuteronomy chapter 2, which Moses also wrote, These Zuzim are also known as the Zamzumim. And they too are part of the Rephaim, or the giants. So now we have a second group, apparently a little bit farther south along that royal road that the Mesopotamians run into and put them down. Then it says that they ran into the Emim in Shavet Kiriathaim. Now, Shavet Kiriathaim seems to be to the east of the Dead Sea Valley area. So they're getting closer to where they want to control, but they're going to loop around to the south first and kind of secure the outer perimeter of where they want to control. It's good, solid work. Now, these Emim are run into in other passages. Let me get one up here in front of me. Deuteronomy, again, written by Moses. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 10 says, "The Emim lived there formerly, a people as great, numerous, and as tall as the Anakim. And like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim, but the Moabites called them Emim." So three groups in a row on the east side of first the Sea of Galilee, then the Jordan Valley, then the Dead Sea Valley. Three groups, three communities of giants that the Mesopotamians have to contend with as they're planning on securing the area of Sodom, Gomorrah, and the cities of the plain. We'll come back and talk about that aspect of this story a little bit more next time we get into the Word.